We've had a day full of different opinions and different disciplines, bringing everything together. And we're all working towards the same goal, but each in his own framework and restrictions and everything that goes with it. Next up, we have the big session. I think while everyone is still here, usually at this time of the day, a lot of attendees would have left to miss the traffic. But luckily, after the session, we'll have drinks. So you can even stay until the traffic is quieted down. So we're still here for the rest of the day. I'll ask Joanna to please come forward. She'll chair the next session. Joanna is the vice chair of the Retirement Matters Committee, for those of you that don't know. And then she'll introduce the rest of the panel to take us through our two-part discussion.
Okay, thanks everyone for staying. This is the session on two parts. I'm sure we all two-part it out. But on the 27th of May, we had a session specifically for DB Fund stuff around two parts. We thought we'd have a general one now to kind of catch all the little bits and pieces that have fallen through. And then we'll have another one at conference once it's in play for 2 months. So we'll see where we are then. I'm not going to really give big bios to my panelists. We've got Johan. I'm just going to give the names and who they represent. So we've got Andrea from Alex Forbes, Shamil, he's talking on behalf of NMG, Michelle Acton from Old Mutual, Brian, who is from GEPF, so that will be exciting as always, and Johan's online from Sanlam's side. So we've got, what I tried to do is get the bigger administrators, please take no offense if your administrator is not here, and if you have any comments to add from your administrator's side, then please do so. This is meant to be an interactive session because I think, you know, there's answers that we've all thought about. So if you have an answer that differs, then please add to the pot. Feel free to interrupt. I'll also be getting a little bit of feedback from Julia. I hope that you enjoy it. I think the first bit that I want to kick off with, and this one's for you, Michelle, is around the outstanding legislation. So the two pieces that are kind of hanging about, which is the amendment to the Pension Funds Act and the Second Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. So if you could just run through what they change and why we need them and what would happen in the event that they're not in place by the 1st of September.
Sure. Can just we turn that. It down a bit? Is that all? Okay, so I think the big thing is that when the 2023 bill, which is now an act, was passed, it was sent to President with a cover note to say, we know that this has got some errors in it, and these errors will be fixed via the Revenue Second Amendment Bill 2024. So many legal people said there's absolutely no way that they'll sign the 23 without signing the 24 because otherwise you've got some errors in legislation. Well, we've had the 23 signed into law. And I think probably some of the main areas of confusion or incorrectness, if I can be just from a high-level perspective, are firstly sitting around the treatment of over-55s. Especially with respect to the date on which the seeding calculation, on which value the seeding calculation is based. Another area, of course, is tax directives and the fact that according to 2023, you need a tax directive for both seeding and intra-fund transfers. And then there's also minor, major, the fact that in the 2023, you can't annuitize a savings pot value. So you'd need to do almost an inter-fund transfer for the amount you don't want to take in cash and have to move it to the retirement pot and then do annuitization, which could be seen more of an admin issue than a particular issue as such. But I think those are some of the high levels. And I think one of the big areas is also around the definition of over 55. There's a bit of inconsistency when you go through a 2023 where sometimes it's quite clear it's you were a member of a fund on the 1st of March 2021, you were over 55, and you are still a member of that same fund. And then, of course, when you move out. So those corrections come through in the 2024, which is still a bill. In fact, my understanding is sometime this month we're expecting the updated draft amendment bill. Just with all the comments and feedback, it'll be open for a very short period of commentary. It'll be closed then, and then hopefully it will go hightail itself right through the parliamentary process to get gazetted. Practically, however, the gazetting will probably happen after the 1st of September, but our understanding is it will still have an effective date of the 1st of September. So on that basis, you know, to be building based on a legislation currently, which we know will change and backdate change, it doesn't really make sense. You've almost got to work on the assumption that the 2024 changes will come into play. Especially anyone involved on the administrator side with the build of readiness, you kind of need to draw the line and go, okay, we need to build on something. I suppose any risk compliance manager right now is hair standing on edge because it means we're building based on unfinalized legislation, but with Tupot, that's how we roll. So of course, at this stage, that's where we are. There's not much one can do about it, and it does create a huge amount of uncertainty, especially for those who haven't been close to discussions and close to what's happening. So I'm getting a lot of questions from intermediaries and stuff around, how can you do that way? Because in 2023, it says that, and you're going, well, we're not basing on 2023, we're basing on 2024. So it does create a lot of uncertainty, but that's where we stand. And then, of course, we've got the last piece of legislation, which is sitting on the president's desk. I'm not sure quite what that means right now with the changes we've had, what needs to happen to get it going through. But that is in its final phases and literally just needing the president's signature. And without that piece of legislation, the biggest aspect is it's minor, big. Funds can't pay claims until that's through. And funds can't implement the change. And then FSCA can't approve rules. So there's a lot waiting on it. I mean, I suppose the big challenge we've got with two parts is this is probably the first piece of change in our industry this large, where normally you have legislation finalized and a line in the sand, and you've got 18 months to go get ready, which is how we used to do this, but we've gone agile. So now you're running the legislation finalization parallel with the readiness, which is creating a massive piece of uncertainty. But, you know, if that's what gets us some preservation element in retirement funds, maybe this little bit of uncertainty is worth it.
Okay, so does everyone agree that we're going to see these two pieces in at least the pension funds amendment before 1 September?
I at this stage, when you speak to the FSCA, when you speak to Treasury, that doesn't seem to be bothering anybody that it's not going to be ready on time. I think maybe the conversation might be slightly different if we're sitting in the middle of August and we haven't seen any move.
Okay.
But.
Okay.
There's an additional complication for the GPF because we've got our own set of legislation, the GP law. And for us to change the GP law, it has to go through a parliamentary process. But for us to change the GP law, because our rules are embedded within the law, we have to first finalize the rule changes and then get the GP law changed. And it's going to be very difficult for that to all be done before 1st of September.
So how are you going to deal with that, though, then, from the GPF side? I expect that your members are expecting something. Come on, September.
As you can see, I'm getting a few more gray hairs. I'm still trying to figure how exactly we can work around that. But that's just an extra complication that we face.
Okay. And from the other administrators, I mean, I hear you saying you're building on the 2024 revenue, those changes. Are the other administrators doing the same?
I'm going to start this side.
Yeah.
Let's go alphabetically. Yes. So at least there should be some consistency for members there, yes, because we're also working for the exact same reason. You can't, if you anticipate a piece of legislation coming forward, it doesn't really make sense to build something that you don't expect to apply either at 1 September or shortly thereafter, and then be backdated. So we are doing the same thing as Old Mutual and working towards what we believe would be the 2024 implementation rules as well. Now, it creates predominantly the over 55s, and it does get complicated when they start transferring between funds, which is also not necessarily clear how to deal with all of that. But we are also working off that piece of legislation. Yeah, the 2020, on the assumption that the 2024 revenue laws bill will be promulgated.
Okay, and the MG as well?
Same, yeah, that it makes sense to use the 2024, but you don't know until the legislation hit the ground. So, but at this stage, that is what we're doing.
Okay, and Johan, from your side, Sanlam as well?
Yes, for Sanlam as well, I think the other big impact is your retirement annuity funds, where previously the seeding was at a fund level or member level, as some called it, versus the bull doing the seeding at a contract level. Now, that kind of change is significant and material for retirement annuities. So there's no way you can roll back or just chop and change between the two dispensations, if I can call it that. So we're also doing the 24 bill.
Okay, great. Are there any questions around legislation? Anything? No? We're good. Right, okay. Now, then... let's talk about maybe the readiness then, given on what we've said, is how likely is it that everything's ready come 1 September? This is neither a marketing ploy or a finger-pointing question. It's just just to check where things are in terms of... Okay, so in terms of systems, in terms of being able to... I guess deal with all the seeding claims, but let's maybe deal with the admin system just because I know you guys have been working quite hard from all the administrators for very long on the systems. So
I thought you were going to ask whether the legislation is ready by 1 September.
Hey?
No, I'm saying that is the legislation going to be ready by 1 September?
I don't know. Let's assume that it is.
So it's going to be important for members that we are ready. That if the legislation is in place, that members are going to come out and say, I want a withdrawal, and then the administrators have to be ready to do that.
Let me rephrase the question. How far off is it for each of the administrators that you would be able to...
So I think
comfortably, yes, we
it depends the definition of readiness. This is where there's often a misconception around member expectations versus what readiness means.
Okay.
So if you're subject to assuming the rules are approved, assuming the legislation is all in place, there's a couple of big chunks of work, and we can sit here and discuss, yes, we'll be ready, and a member can complete a claim form and hand it in. But it's whether you have the ability to actually process that claim form in the volumes you're expecting them to arrive, because the volumes we're expecting are quite dramatic.
Mm. And is there some sort of like planning or phasing or some sort of like staggered approach that the administrators are considering in terms of processing these claims?
So I think there's two elements. The one is being ready to process them. That's I think the first big. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to have created the pots in your pension administration systems. And people underplay that, right? So there isn't a process flow, etc., that's not going to be touched by Two-Pot. Mm. So there's a lot of focus on seeding and paying the claim, but there's so much more you have to have ready before you can even pay the claim. And that's creating the pots, that's enabling all your transactions to flow correctly, that's moving your existing savings into the vested pot for those members where it applies to. And even, I mean, some of the things that it doesn't even get discussed is the concept of people who are supposed to exit the end of August that haven't even exited yet. They also need to be seated because they're still in the fund on the 1st of September, etc. But it's creating that foundation. Then you've created the foundation, which creates the pots, and then the next phase is doing the seeding.
But let's just stop there. So how far are we off from having created the pots?
Look, I mean, from our side...
is it still far, or is it like almost...
I think that's administrator-specific.
Okay.
It would be administrator-specific. Mm. I mean, we've done a lot of development, so I can speak from Alex Forbes' side, and we've done testing, but I do agree with the sentiment to say to be Two-Pot ready is not necessarily only a function of being able to pay it. So from a system perspective, I have a fair amount of comfort that the systems are going to be ready. They can, you know, the testing's happened, the development has happened. But what will complicate it in my mind is the ability to pay that claim. So the interaction with SARS to get the directive, whether or not that fund's rules are approved. So you have to not only be able to do the system setup, but now you need to keep track on whether or not the fund has approved rules or not, and you know, make sure that there's no overlaps in that. So I think from an administrative perspective, the the system capability development is on track. But whether or not everything can be brought together to be able to process every person's claim that has an expectation to that money is something that is not as easy to answer, because the problem is that it's not only a function of system capability. There's a lot of variables.
There are external dependencies.
And even just the tax directive process is tricky, because who has the member's taxable salary? Not the fund, and not necessarily the employer, and you can't necessarily ask the member. So to be able to get the directive, you'd be reliant on SASH. But at the point when a person withdraws, they might even not know what their taxable income is. So it's a little bit messy 100% in practicality.
And then I think if I can add to that, the legislation says you must do your seeding on or after the 1st of September, based on the value as at the 31st of August. And if you've done it later, you must just backdate to make sure it's as if it was effective the 1st of September. So even if you've created this payment capability, if for some reason your fund hasn't been able to do the seeding yet, and the timing of seedings between various administrators will depend on all these calcs, checks, et cetera, and for over 55s, there will be no seeding on the 1st of September, because that'll start the following month. And so you might all be ready, but you haven't done seeding. That doesn't mean you're not compliant. That doesn't mean – it just means you haven't done the seeding yet, because you might not have the 31st of August value until a few days later. You might have to have a few checks and see. So there's so many dependencies. And I think one of the scary, scary things is I was speaking to a group of members where their expectation was on the 1st of September, the money was going to be in their bank accounts. Not that they would have to apply, because just like every month payroll deducts their money out of their salary, they expect it automatically to be put back into their account on the 1st of September. And I think so it's about understanding. And the tax element's massive. I mean, the integration with the volumes, with tax directives, and members having their information ready and having to ask for it, there's quite a bit of moving pieces.
I think that what I wanted to get out of that question is just comfort for people just around the actual physical system setup. You know, like in theory, everything's ready to go. If you get only one claim, come 1st of September, that it will be able to get processed, that when contributions come in, they'll go into their different pots and all of that. And I think that it feels like there's a bit of reluctance to give, 100% comfort? No? I don't know. It's like I'm reading the room here.
So I'm just...
It depends. We're actuaries.
Earlier today, we heard about the outstanding contributions by employers. When employers didn't pay the contributions timely to members, which means that even all of those records are not going to be up to date by the time we get to the end of August. There is the system, and then there is the actual practical
100%.
Numbers that must come into the system in order to do the processing. There's that element as well from the employer side, the intermediaries, to make sure that they actually make sure employers pay the contributions that are due to members.
But I mean, from a system perspective, as the administrator working on your system, that's one of the parts that you can control. Like, you can't control the legislation, the rules, clients, whatever. Are all the administrators here comfy that from an admin system setup point, it's going to be okay, except for you, maybe?
Because my bosses are not here. I don't think we'll be fully ready, but we'll have a minimum viable product ready by 1st September. The decision we've taken going forward up until the system is fully ready is to treat any potential savings withdrawal benefit as a normal benefit. So we'll adhere to the 60-day payment rule, and that will buy us some time to possibly handle the volumes that we are likely to face. So our biggest challenge is we haven't had enough time to stress test the system to handle the volumes. And my gut feel is that our system is probably not ready to handle the large volumes that are expected. But as a contingency measure, the payments won't be as quick as other administrators have communicated. I think we'll stick to a 60-day rule, and that will buy us some time to increase our capacity to handle the volumes.
Okay. Johan, you were wanting to say something?
Yeah, I think the other challenge is, and what we're seeing, if you ask us whether we're ready today, we'll say yes, but we may not be ready tomorrow. And the reason, I think one big outstanding thing is the SARS business requirement specification, they call it a BRS, and that's the tax directive requirements of SARS. Now, I think it's okay for the cash withdrawal from the savings pot, but we know the BRS is not finalized for normal resignations and retirements. And that is problematic in the sense that if there's scope changes coming through in that BRS requirement, we need time in order to develop our systems to align to that BRS. And at this point, I must say, it is creating a lot of nervousness not having the final BRS on the table.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, I mean, just to put it in perspective, I think it was end of June, we basically got, or middle of June, we got updated BRS from SARS on the savings pot, which included the IT88. So up until then, the IT88 hadn't been confirmed. Now, pulling an IT88 on a tax directive for a savings pot, that's if you owe outstanding tax to SARS, is like a rebuild. So you have to go back and you've built this whole process around tax directives, and now SARS has said, actually, IT88 is in, despite our asking us, please put it away and go away and come back in 2 years from now. So that means now when you do the tax directive, which needs to be automated, right? Let's be honest. You can't handle these volumes unless your tax directive process and claims payment is automated. There's no manual swivel chairs involved here. You've got to now go and change all those steps and those processes that you already built and probably tested to go rebuild and retest. So I think the other challenge is, even with what we've got, most of us are probably in full testing phases, right? We've got 6 weeks to go. And so things can come up in testing. So I think everybody's working as hard as they can, but it is a really, really difficult ask. And Johan, I think you make a great point. There is no focus on the withdrawal claim. So everyone's focusing on these savings pot claims and are people going to be able to submit their claims, etc. But from the 2nd of September, if someone resigned at the end of August, they must be able to withdraw on the new basis with both the savings and the vested pots having to have a withdrawal. So your resignation claim process has to be completely revamped, which in some ways is so much bigger than a savings pot process. Because a savings pot, I'm saying to a member, if you want to come claim, come get your money. This is a 17 forms or whatever you need to complete. This is how, trust me, if you're going to get money, members will need to go through it. They'll go through it. But now you're going through a process of saying, Mr. Employer, you know you used to use the form that looked like that. Okay, now it can't look like that anymore. Please change your forms. Make sure your members are... That change management piece is astronomical. Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, I can imagine on your space where you've got all your different branches and areas, I mean, just trying to get people knowing, don't use that claim form anymore, use this one, this is the new way it's going to be done. So there is a lot of work that needs, so systems is one aspect, assuming all the testing and SARS doesn't change anything more. And I mean, their systems are now open for testing. So I think the opportunity for testing is now there. They're open for trade testing, but it's still, when you start testing, do you know how it's working and going through. But there's a lot of moving parts with respect to this.
And I agree with that. So I think for us, one of the important aspects to understand is it fundamentally changes your approach to administration in a certain way, because it's not only building this capability of paying a saving component withdrawal, which is important, and it is a brand new claim type, which in effectively also means that where previously your pay points were your employers, you effectively have to make every member a pay point, which is massive. But other than that, it breaks some of your existing processes that you'd have to now redo. So exactly that, the withdrawal components, etc. So where you in the past were able to do straight through processing on paying essentially that whole benefit out, now you're left with retirement component that you can't do a straight through processing on and pay out. So it's not only building the capability to do one aspect of it, but it's making sure that the existing framework still works with new rules and new kind of terms of engagement. And that has been the difficult part in getting the systems ready. But as mentioned, I'm from a system perspective, as it currently stands, but I agree with you, Anne, tomorrow it might be a different story if the whole dynamic changes due to external factors. So I wouldn't necessarily point it down to hesitancy, but it is an impossible question to answer whilst the rules within which you have to operate that system is still very much a moving target. And therefore, you can never definitively say because you don't know what the definitive framework is. So it's been a magnanimous task to get ready. It really has.
Yeah, and I, if I can add this, I think in the beginning of the project, we all had this ambitions to automate as many as possible things and seamlessness. But with all the scope changes that's come through during the course of this project, you were sort of pushed back from those aspirations, and the objective is just simply to be compliant by 1 September, and you'll have to do the bells and whistles after that. So we will see evolution continuing of Tupot in the way we administer and deal with it in the industry, I think. Thanks.
Okay, thanks everyone. I remembered, I forgot to ask Julia when we were talking about rules. She does have some feedback for us on what the rule process was and where the FSCA, just where the rules are at. So maybe if you could give us that before we move on.
Thanks, Jana. So I spoke to our rules lady before the session today because I wanted to have an idea of how many rules we've received and how many are still outstanding. So I know that on Monday last week we had received 267 rule amendment requests, and at the start of today, in other words before this conference started, we had reached 500. So there were a lot of submissions over the past week. I can tell you what the process is from the FSCA's point of view. So on the system, there's a special drop-down menu where you say that this is a two-part rule amendment, and that's so that it follows the correct process. And the rule amendments that have been submitted are being considered as they are submitted, and queries are being raised where relevant. And from our perspective, from a legal point of view, the rules cannot be approved until the pension funds amendment bill has been assented by the president. And this is something that both SARS and ourselves are in alignment with. That needs to be assented first before the subsequent things can be done. So those rule amendments are ready to, okay, maybe not the 200 that we received over the past couple of days, but the rule amendments where there were no questions, where there's no concerns, they're ready to be approved, but that bill must first be signed. So you should see that those will be approved relatively quickly because there is a special team in place, there's special processes in place so that they can be done quickly. And the deadline for submission of those rule amendments was today. And 500 is not the number of funds that we expected. So there's a lot of funds that...
That was at the beginning of the day.
It was at the beginning of the day, literally. It was at 7 this morning, so you never know. It might be more now.
There's still time.
But yes, they're all ready to actually
go.
Go as soon as that bill has been signed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you
very much. Does anyone have any questions on system builds? Questions for Julia about rules?
That bit before we... for Julia.
Just want to ask Megan.
Hi. My question to the administrators is, I mean, this seems like an amazingly inefficient way to work. You know, like you're building stuff while the plane is flying. And how much has this uncertainty cost members? Or how much will it cost members? Because ultimately it's all going to be passed on to the members. And do we have any idea of how much the poor political process, the poor legislative process has cost people?
Shall we deal with that alphabetically again? Perfect, thank you. Look, so I think that has been one of the difficult components of doing cost analysis to determine what's a fair and reasonable fee to pass on to members. I think the reality, though, Megan, is a lot of this uncertainty and inefficiency will actually be a cost for the administrators rather than a fee for the members. We, for example, have already agreed on our fee that we'll pass on to members, and that fee won't change if we now have to adapt for more changes in the legislative process that I would anticipate. So to date, we haven't set a proviso to our fee reviews to say, look, if we have to do more changes, we'll potentially ask you more. It doesn't mean that you won't review fees, but I think the reality is a lot of this inefficiency is yes, there will be a cost for members, but by and large, at least our approach has been to see what is the fair cost and not necessarily the opportunity cost, because it's internal time that's being spent on all the testing and not necessarily the development cost, by and large, sits into, I think those rules are fairly wide enough to establish the pots, to split the contributions, to get the reporting up. Doesn't necessarily change that much depending. It's some of the capabilities that you would need to build and test. And so by and large, the cost has been internal. And I don't, it will affect members, but I do think a large part of this cost was opportunity cost for the administrators themselves that had to spend the, you know, the hours and hours spent internally to go back to the drawing board and to understand and unpack this. And that's not a direct cost that will go to members. I think the direct cost will be related to more to the direct system expenses, but the testing and the building and et cetera is very much an opportunity cost, which is in any event very difficult to quantify.
Who's next?
Yeah, because changes in legislation is an ongoing thing in any administrator's life. So I fully agree with the point that it's opportunity cost. You simply spend your IT resources on Tupot instead of another project in the business, and that is really tricky to quantify. I fully agree.
Yeah, from our side also, there's no impact on members in terms of the development costs that you need to incur.
I also think it's just about the readiness and how long it's going to take. So Johan, you made the comment of not everything's going to be able to be automated, and you've got to be MVP, and you're going to start adding beyond that. And the question is, that could have had a lot more ready on time, but now it's going to take longer. But the ultimate solution, you're just going to be, for the next year, we're probably all going to be doing tweaks to our two-pot processes as we learn, build, and add, and automate. Mm-hmm. I think a big cost, though, is the opportunity cost, but I think the second element is the uncertainty cost has put massive pressure on the change management side. So we focused a lot here on the cost to build to make sure the systems are right. But the systems are actually a small component of this two-part. Mm. It's the change management and the understanding the rules and how it's going to work and member comms and what they can do and how can they can do it and intermediaries. That part's massive with all of these changes. Because you say one thing and then the next while you're saying something else. And people go, okay, do you know what you're talking about? And so that has also, I mean, there isn't much... people are still asking, can the date move? You know, is the date actually going to happen or is it going to move? And if you're still asking that question where we are now, you know, it's just going to mean also when you hit 1 September to go live or when the new legislation comes into play, I think those first couple of months are going to be insane. I mean, we can sit and say what we like, but it's going to be a crazy time with people landing the new processes, landing the new systems, understanding how it all works. And that I think is harder to land sooner if you've got so much uncertainty.
And I think the unfortunate thing for members that I do hope we manage, and at least the big administrators do get right, is this ability to implement two-pot. Because I think over the past decade, we've worked very hard to make the industry better for members, to build trust, to get more people to want to participate in the system. And I hope that the uncertainty doesn't lead to a situation where we are unable to successfully execute and therefore break trust or lose trust in the system, because it is a good development. But if people don't have a positive engagement and positive experience of it, you break trust in that system. And so for that, for us, is this fundamental understanding that everything is on the line. There is no getting it wrong. We have to get it right. And I think there's a lot of nervous energy going into that, because we understand the importance to the industry at large of demonstrating that the individual can have trust in the system. And that's been very important for us as well, because it will ultimately have a massive impact if people don't see the benefit of the legislation or they have a negative experience, engagement experience. And so the uncertainty is not helping with building the trust.
I just wanted to give some input from the GPF side, because we operate slightly differently where we allocate a budget to administrator. We had put in a buffer of 10% to the budget to help cover for the development and member education costs that we anticipate. But what we are beginning to see is that the 10% was an underestimate, and we probably have to motivate for a bit more for us to fully cover the cost, the increased costs.
You're not alone.
Yeah, we underestimated the size of this build. I think it's becoming a standard line.
I've got a question for Julia.
Okay,
yeah.
Question for Julia.
Yeah, so I've got a question for the FSCA, and that is sometimes we submit rule amendments, and then the rule amendments are subjected to some query relating to the compliance of the fund with its financial or board composition, stuff like that. I just wanted to know at this stage, will the two-part rule amendments just be unconditionally approved, or would also be subject to the normal rule amendment process?
There is a streamlined process, but if a rule amendment is submitted by a board that is not duly constituted, it is not a board. It cannot take a decision, and hence the rule amendment cannot be approved because they could not have submitted it. So it must be legally correct for it to be approved. So the board issue is still an issue that needs to be a properly constituted board for that rule amendment to be looked at.
And other matters relating to fund compliance? And
it depends on what the matter is. So, for example, say the valuation report hasn't been accepted. This is not something that relies on... It's not something that's going to impact the financial soundness of the fund. It's something that's going to impact what you're going to pay. So they don't need the valuation report to be approved for the rule amendment to be considered. So it does depend on what the non-compliance is, what is going to be considered and what is not. Perhaps while I've got the mic, one of the other really important points is that if the rule amendment is not approved, that fund cannot pay any savings benefit to any member. So all the legal parts must be in place.
Can I add another question? Sorry, Julia, before you give your mic away. If I may.
Oh, dear.
No,
Julia didn't want to be on
just maybe feedback, if it's possible. I mean, you mentioned the fact that you've got 500 rule amendments, but you can't give the final stamp until the approval. Is it possible to at least get an indication from the FSCA to say, we've been through your rule amendment, we're now happy, as soon as the legislation's passed, we'll approve it? Because then we at least know, funds know, that it's just a matter of passing the legislation. There's not going to be five more queries coming through after that. It's just creating a bit of certainty. That's the only my only feedback, if that's possible. Otherwise, you don't know if you're going to get another query raised or if it's just a matter of waiting for the legislation to be gazetted.
I don't have an answer for you. I can take it up with Fikile because it's her department that's doing it. I don't know whether she would send that kind of communication, but I can take it up with her.
Andrea, I wanted to pick up on your point on building trust. I think a lot of this, and we heard earlier as well, is around communicating and to members, to the financial advisors, to potentially the employers. So I assume you guys have been doing quite a bit of that. So I just wondered what if any feedback you had had, and also, as someone raised before, what the focus has been on the preservation aspect. I know, Brian, you were saying earlier that you'd had a member session with members and they were quite surprised at the preservation, at the preservation component of it. So if there's any feedback that you'd like to give in terms of what you've seen being communicated and / all the types of communication or what's come out of it or feedback that you've received from clients.
So alphabetically again. Yes, I mean, I won't rehash the communication efforts. I think Davi and Rita from our side at least did showcase some of the thinking there. We've obviously appointed a lot more people to assist with that communication process. What's been interesting is I have done a couple of member engagement sessions myself, and one of my evaluators as well on a large fund that works with me on a large fund, she actually did a survey in the like a Mentimeter in the session, which I thought was such a great idea just to throughout test some understanding. And what was very clear for me in that feedback was that members appreciate in that session specifically, they appreciated the preservation, the withdrawal, the vested, all of that. What was completely misunderstood is the tax application. The fact that different tax laws, tax rules apply for different exit events, and the fact that the saving component will be at marginal rate, and in fact, what a marginal rate is, what that means. The tax was, in that session particularly, it was about 1,000 members that attended from a large employer, but that aspect, very few people were able to answer the question in terms of what tax would apply on withdrawal, what tax would apply on resignation. retirement and what's the tax on your saving component. So we've explained it, but that concept in that specific engagement was very difficult for people to...
And I just want to check, I mean, the seeding is compulsory, so you can't decide to just leave it in your vested pot and...
You just leave it in your savings pot. You just don't touch it.
Yeah,
until
but if
retirement.
You do touch it, then you get tax marginal rates. Whereas if you leave it in your vested pot, you wouldn't.
No, well, not if you only touch it at retirement, then the tax it's neutral. It's completely neutral.
Yeah.
So,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So if you were to withdraw at any point or view it as part of your withdrawal benefit, there's no instance where the saving component will have withdrawal tax tables applied to it. So that's the big one. Then the ultimate answer is you leave it until retirement, and then it's part of the retirement tax table. But this aspect of marginal tax rates, and it's going to be even more messy if they attach historic, if there's tax issues, if there's IT88s attached to it, then it's going to be, to the extent that the administrator first has to settle any tax liability to SARS before they're able to pay out. Some of the feedback, people will, there might be an understanding that the administrator is taking my money. It's going to be very difficult.
So who's communicating the tax to members and how?
So I think that's each of the administrators' responsibilities. And I mean, SARS had
there
said...
It will literally say you will be taxed on marginal tax.
Yeah, so this has been... Yeah.
That's not a community...
So we've had exactly the same. So we've gone out and we've actually released a calculator to show people how much they can draw out of their fund in September and what tax they'll pay. And there's been a massive uproar. That's not my tax. That's not right. What do you mean I'm going to pay tax? Why is Old Mutual taking tax? They don't associate SARS with the tax being taken. So it is this. I mean, we discussed the fact that it's marginal tax rate up until before, and then at retirement, it's your retirement tax lump sum tax tables. There's misconfusion about savings pot accumulating to that 550 tax free, which it doesn't. So there's a huge amount of confusion about the tax, and it's not simple. I mean, even advisors, I've been on the phone for hours with financial advisors around trying to unpack the tax treatment. And you're right. I mean, if I'm leaving the fund at the end of August and I haven't submitted my claim, I'm going to get seated, which means my one part will be taxed at marginal and my other part will be taxed at my withdrawal tax tables. There is no choice. It's not like you can opt out. That's just how it's going to be. So the tax piece is massively confusing. But the other thing that we're finding is people don't understand how the fund works currently. So you're going to them going, this is how two-pot changes everything. And they're going, well, how does it work at the moment? And can I resign now? What happens if I'm on my notice period in September? Do I still get this concept of vested pots? Is also completely misunderstood.
So for the GPF, we had a dual problem in that we had some of the representatives of members presenting a different working for the two-pot, maybe based on what they had, what had been communicated to them, to what is actually on the ground. So we had to dispel the rumors that members would have, they'll be able to access a third of the vested pot. So once they understood that part, they were immediately not happy. Then there were also, it was not clearly communicated that the retirement pot would be preserved and we'd have limited access to it. So once we communicated that clearly to them, again, there's been a lot of uproar. There's even now, there's a certain union that even threatened to take us to court for a decision they pushed forward. And then also now that they fully understand the tax implications of the savings pot, there's also been a lot of uproar about that. So two months ago, there were a lot of members who were in favor of the two pot, but in the past few weeks, there are a lot more who are disgruntled and are not happy with the present structure.
And I must say, having gone through quite a number of rule amendments recently to get them into play, I think the options that are available to members on certain exit events are going to be confusing for them to understand. So, for example, that you can't preserve. So, if you're taking your vested component, you can't leave the other parts in the fund. You have to go to a press fund. You can transfer to multiple funds, but you can't transfer the different pots to different funds, for example. They have to move together. Those types of intricacies, the vested portion, so what's available as in cash at retirement versus what's subject to the one-third, two-thirds. It's the non-vested portion plus the retirement component, and then the vested plus the... It is going to be significantly... I mean, I've had to draw pictures. for myself, just to understand it, little luck bubbles, what can happen, what not. And that, I think, once we're fully in the system and people start doing something different to other than just saving component withdrawals, but start transferring between funds or certain resignations happen, retirements happen, it is going to be the consequence of doing certain things you won't necessarily be able to undo. And then there's the tax, and then obviously just as explaining the option. So that it is a complicated system. It's going to be difficult to explain to members what their options are and what the tax ramifications of those options are, in my experience.
And so yeah. who gives the members that kind of level of advice? I mean, I'm a member from my fund. I would get, I assume, EB consultants that are in the room that refuse to be part of my panel, no one in particular, that your clients are seeing similar. I mean, you're seeing the similar thing from your clients, right? I assume that the concerns are the same.
Yeah.
Silence will be taken as consent. So who is the person? Because, I mean, the fund, I can imagine, would say, you know, marginal tax rates apply, and this applies on this benefit, and this applies on this benefit, but no one actually does the calculation for you, and even marginal tax rate based on what? Based on your earnings with the employer, based on your last tax year of So who would assist the members with that? Do they need to be assisted? Presumably, they would need to be assisted with that?
I think in our member servicing model, your benefit counselor will start playing a far more bigger role than they currently are. But I think what's going to happen is probably your administrator, your benefit consultant, your benefit counselor, everyone is going to have to jump in to help explain this big change to members. I don't think any particular role player in the value chain is going to be able to do it.
Okay. In isolation.
The other challenge is, because it's so complex, you find that your counselors don't even fully understand how the support system works.
Because I was thinking about the financial advisors, and it's still complicated even for a financial advisor to understand. Unless you're a tax specialist in retirement fund tax.
Yeah, and there's a lot of factors these financial advisors need to take into account, because this also impacts RAs, right? Mm. So there's also that whole. Yes. So, I think this is where people underplay something this big. Mm. So the focus has always been savings pot. But that withdrawal, I mean, like the same, we map it out, trying to how do we make the form the nicest that everyone can follow the flow and understand which box they're ticking. It's still going to end up on a phone call. And does that phone call go to the employer? Or does that phone call go to the call center? Or does that phone call end up at the benefit counselor? Or the financial advisor now has to still get involved? I mean, does this become an additional role for the EB consultants? Because, you know, assisting and supporting members on exits becomes one of those
things. An actual job.
No. So these are the areas where I think are completely, there's not enough focus going on them, because there's so much focus on getting the systems ready and making sure that it comes. But it's the true understanding of putting a member in front of this. It's what do the employers need to do differently, you know?
And what has the communication to members, because everyone's very focused on communicating this to members and how they must do it. And I know I've heard quite a lot about automated claims, and the whole thing's automated. You just need to click a button and you get your claim. But, not that bad, but that kind of process. To what extent has the communication to members been, just chill out, you don't need to do anything, you don't need to panic, this doesn't go away, you don't have to do it in September, you can do it in December or next year, you know?
Like, or not at all.
Or not at all.
Not at all.
You know, to what extent has that kind of been emphasized? Because it seems like there's this franticness for everyone to come running, and it almost feels like we may be creating the thing that we don't want.
So we have tried to bring forward that message that it's an option, it's not an obligation. You don't have to exercise this option. You can leave it as is. But the challenge is the expectation is already there.
Yeah.
Some people have been waiting for this since 2020.
Sure.
So they're waiting for the first opportunity in which they can access their retirement savings. So even though the messaging is out there, I'm not sure it will be enough to stop someone who has already made up their mind to withdraw.
And have we seen communication that says kind of we are working on it, but we may not be 100% ready on 1 September, or things may not be 100% ready, so it's not going away and it's not because of anything we've done, just to kind of set that expectation, or are we just kind of not doing that?
I think the media actually plays a big role in this as well, because when the president signed in the legislation, it was immediately on News 24 to say it's in now.
So, yeah, but I mean, so from the fund side, is there some, like, or should there be something to say, actually, you know, we know it's in, we're still waiting for this and this and this and this. So
we've done, I mean, I think the answer to that is yes. But there's a couple of elements that the problem with communication. Like, there's this easy, have you sent your members communication, right? You know, have you covered all of these factors? The answer is yes. However, what people don't realize is you can send it to members. Whether they read it or not is another thing. We find, you know, when you we can measure emails, WhatsApp, read rates, etc. It's not sitting at 100%. So you can send the message. It's whether it's actually landing in terms of that. But also we've done some testing around, you know, are you going to take your money, are you not, what would you do with it, etc. And those that have decided, it doesn't matter, you can tell them till you're blue in the face, you shouldn't touch it and wait, it's not the right thing. For this hype, I think there's going to be two phases. There's going to be this massive hump because of the seeding and everyone going to, but then I think it'll settle down, but there's a major focus on this initial seeding that people are going to get access, even though some people are asking me if it happens annually. which demonstrates the lack of understanding. And vast majority of people have said they're accessing their money and they're accessing it to settle debt. They're not they're trying to do wild things like buy fancy cars or go on holidays. The people are so indebted and in such, they can't see the wood from the trees, that now this is an opportunity to get money to be able to help put towards this debt. That's what they want to do. The question is, how soon can they do it? And that's, you know, we can educate and try and tell people it's not a good idea. Look what it's going to affect your replacement ratio. Please don't access. But with where a lot of South Africans, especially when we look at the fact that 70% of members on funds in this country earn below 20 grand a month, the focus is very much on, I need that money and I need it to settle debt.
And most people think they can get 30,000.
Yeah, they're waiting for the 30th or the third, like you mentioned.
Yeah, so, and in some cases, it's not going to be 30.
No. Yeah, so where are communication to members?
If I can add this on the member communication side, and also your intermediaries and participating employers, I mean, we've been saying for a long time, please register on the app. Register your members for tax. I think that is going to prevent a lot of members from making a withdrawal. If you draw stats on your admin system, you know, there's some funds with as low as 30% of members are registered for tax. So now you have to go and register for tax first before you can make a cash withdrawal. I think it is Huka, Old Mutual, that wrote that article in the press that said, you know, I don't think you can just come and make a withdrawal. You need to register for tax. You need to tell us what your taxable income is. You need to probably register on your service provider's app before you can make a cash withdrawal. So what I think is going to happen is we're going to see far more queries than actual processing of cash withdrawals from the savings component, because there are all these things that needs to get into place before you can make a withdrawal. And despite our best efforts to communicate and train and educate, unfortunately, repetition is key. You have to explain something 5-6 times before the penny drops. As Andrea mentioned, you know, I also had to draw pictures for myself on all the do's and don'ts when you resign, for example, in respect of each pot. It's hell of complicated. So once of communication is not going to do the trick, I think it's going to be an ongoing thing for a long time.
We'll compare pictures, Johan, to see who can draw the best. But
I'm just hoping are all the same. That's what's worrying me.
Bubbles and squares.
What's the difference? So where have we misinterpreted?
So, Jana, where we have actively told members that, you know, come 1 September, there won't be an immediate value available. It's obviously for the DB members, but because you have to perform the calculations, right? We have to wait for the salaries that come in with August contribution. So we have just over 3,000 DB members under administration through various kind of private sector funds, which pales in significance to the 1.2 million that Brian will have to fend off come 1 September. But it is a significant portion. So we've been actively communicating to try and explain what the DB process will be. Calculations will need to be performed. You need to see the service equivalent, et cetera, et cetera. So on the DB front, but arguably, again, it is smaller fines, fewer members. It's easier to get them into a room to make sure that you relay the messages.
And they're mostly
older. They're mostly older. I mean, for them, for many of our fines, 30,000 is a couple of days in service terms. I mean, it's not even a full month that you're not gonna see, because these are large benefits of older individuals. So we have to look at the definitions of the service as well. You can't necessarily talk in full service months. It has to be a finer or smaller unit. And so on those funds, I think there is an appreciation, at least, that they, you know, they would. But I also don't necessarily anticipate those members to be the ones who will be knocking for the 30 guys. So that's where we're kind of comfortable that people will understand, hopefully, that, you know, come 1 September, there's some water that needs to flow under the bridge before we're able to process anything. And hopefully we won't see too much of activity. But again, the point is you have to be ready. Even, you know, even if they access that component or not, you have to be able to give them that option. So there's a lot of work going into that as well.
Well, thanks. That brings us nicely to the DB section, or a bit on the DB section. So the first one, I think, that came out of the previous session on the 27th of May was there was a conversation about the calculations, MIR, ARV. I was going to have a little Mentimeter poll thing, but there's so few people actually here that I decided not to. So maybe we can just get a show of hands if there's a favoritism. The one that I've heard most in the people that I've surveyed so far has been ARVs. If you're an ARV person, please raise your hand. Okay. And an MIR person. If you're MIR, please raise your hand. And the rest of you don't have DB funds. Okay, so it's predominantly ARV. I've also heard an ARV subject to MIR, which feels a little bit complicated. So at the previous session, I think that we'd felt that it would be useful to get some guidance just so that there's consistency in the industry, because both methods would be defensible, both methods give you slightly different answers. So we have approached the FECA for that, so we're going to draft them a request letter to consider some form of, information note, I don't know the terminology, one of those that can be issued just to give consistency across the board, so that we're all kind of doing the same thing. So we'll see what happens with that. If any of you have anything else that you would like the FECA to give guidance on that would be helpful, you can speak now or send me an email or send Julian, or send me an email or Stephen, and then we'll incorporate it. Someone also raised the basis, the timing of the basis change for the calculations. I mean, currently it's only for runs on your previous valuation. Do you do it when your valuation is submitted, when it's approved? I think mostly when it's submitted. I don't know if anyone waits for approval, but that will depend. So if we want kind of clarity on that, let me know, please. I don't know if Shamil, if you want to say anything on that.
Yeah, so just before we get to the evaluations are not approved. They're actually accepted by the FECA. So your basis that you've adopted, unless they challenge your basis, that would be the basis that you'd use in your evaluation. Particularly, I'm talking about DB funds now. So even the DC funds, the evaluations are never approved. I don't know if you read the letter you get from the FECA. It actually says accepted. So the responsibility is still on the evaluator to make sure that whatever he has put in the report is correct, or she put in the report is correct, and that the certification of the financial soundness of the fund is correct. So my idea of the withdrawal benefit, these once-off or actually annual withdrawals, is that we should actually treat it for the elders in the room like we used to calculate buying back service for members. You remember that a member could transfer money, I think maybe GPF probably still provides for that.
Yeah.
So they used to say I'm bringing in 10,000 rand, or I'm going to, I've got some bonus, I put it into the fund, and the employer agrees to that he can buy back service, he can backdate his service. And the way the calculation was done was actually the ARV. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in those years, there wasn't surplus legislation, so the ARV should be subject to a minimum of then the MR, and that would be the basis. And then if he comes in 2 years' time or 6 months' time, and you've done a valuation and you've changed the basis, then you use the new basis for that calculation. That is my view on how one can actually adopt the approach of a fairness to the member and to the remaining members in the fund. There is a question of once the valuation basis is strengthened or weakened. I mean, if it's strengthened, then it means it's less service that he can get for the same amount of money. That might put some risk on the employer, and what will be the response of the employer as having to pay for that extra risk? Or if it weakens, then he obviously buys more service than what he would have done in the first place.
Thank you. Are we happy with that? Kind of. Are there any other questions technically on calculations?
Joanna, if there are no questions on that, we have a few online questions, if I can ask them. The first two for Julia. Oh, no, it's seven, sorry. No. Just the two. Will the DB two-part rule amendments all be referred to Julia and the team for consideration before being approved? And then the second one, what is the FECA going to do if a fund has submitted its rule amendment, not today, but before the 1st of September, and actually pay benefits from the savings component on 1 September or during September in order to prevent riots?
Thanks. I think I'm going to go home now. There will definitely be internal discussions about DB fund rule amendments, and presumably the ones that look similar, they're not all going to be referred to us, but the basic wording will be referred to us because we do get more involved with DB funds. So yes, there will be some things referred to us. Regarding what is going to be done for funds that pay illegally, well, there you go, there's the answer. It's illegal. Whether we take action or someone else takes action or what action is going to be taken, I really can't tell you. I don't know. But it's important to note that it's illegal. So if you're doing something illegal, be careful.
Then a few other ones. To the administrators, where is the critical mass for the administrators in terms of number of claims that they can process? For example, if a third of the members claim, will you be able to handle that? Or do you anticipate being able to handle 50% or two-thirds?
Are we again going alphabetically?
Either way.
Look, so from our perspective, if the capability exists, it's not necessarily tied to that number. So we've done some quite extensive predictive analysis to try and understand, and within quite wide range of anticipated claims. So we've modeled up to about half of the people coming 1 September. It's difficult to say if there's a critical mass. In my opinion, if you're ready, our view is to be ready and to be able to process it. So that's going to be the target. We're not saying, well, we'd be ready to process 500,000 claims, but not 550. I don't know. That's never been the internal. We've obviously appointed more resources to try and assist with that as well. So it's not only getting the systems ready, but it's also spending quite a significant amount of time and effort to get your resources right as well. So appointing people and making sure that you've got hands on deck to process the claims. So the intention is not to reach a critical mass. The intention is to be able to process the claims. Mm-hmm. There might be errors, we might not make them, there might be, but the consequence of that would be delays. It's going to take a little bit longer, not that you won't process the claim.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the interesting thing is we yet wait to see how much capacity SARS can take.
Yes.
Because, of course, they're going to be hundreds of thousands of tax directives submitted daily, so it's in terms of what that means in terms of being able to cope. I think all systems get their performance and penetration testing to make sure they can handle the volumes and what it looks like. But the bigger problem is not going to be the system of when I submit the claim and it goes through and it goes to all the steps and the disinvestments, et cetera, to pay the member. I think a big piece is going to be that initial validation of the member. And as much as we try in advance to tell people to go and update your details, make sure your information is correct on the system, when we come to validate, if you haven't validated your information, it's going to get stuck. And it's how that process, and that's where your call center start coming into play. And how big do you build your call center to manage the volumes? How many people are going to get stuck in that process, et cetera? So I think that's going to be probably where it's going to have a bit of a challenge. And I think all administrators have run numbers and worked out how many people. And there's also only so big you can get before it becomes unmanageable in terms of training and in recruiting as many staff as you need. So I think it's going to be more of a challenge around how do we make sure if John and Glorville phones, we need to make sure we can validate that's the gentleman, his information is correct on the system so he can go through back online and process the claim or whichever way. And that's where the volumes are going to handle. And plus, in general, I mean, if you look at how many people have a reason to phone the call center in a retirement fund at the moment, it's pretty close to zero. I mean, you can pretty model, if someone goes online to check values, within 3 months, they're going to be putting in their resignation claim, right? That's really what happens at the moment. You've now got a reason for 100% of your members to reach out to you, even if it's just finding out how do I, my favorite question is if you move the money and split it now in two parts, it's going to be invested in saving, am I going to get less investment return because the money's in two parts now, not one? And this is where the volumes are going to be. It's going to be an exceptionally noisy time for everybody in the industry, even if you're doing everything 100% right. And it's just going to be able to, how are you going to cope with those sort of volumes that are going to come through?
So I can't give a critical mass value, but I can just throw in some figures to show how much trouble I'll be facing. Currently, before Two-Pot, we have an average of, let's say, 5,000 claims a month that we do, 5,000 cases that we deal with. If half the people who or half of the active members come forward, it means we'll be facing 50,000 a month. So that's a tenfold increase in claims or benefits that we need to process. So whether we can really handle it, I think we'll only know with time, but we've tried to build the capability to at least receive all those claims.
On the member communication, have you communicated to members what the admin fees will be for a savings spot withdrawal? And on the tax especially, will you communicate to them, listen, but you have this IT88 outstanding and your marginal rate is this, and let them reconsider? Or once you get that tax directive, will you just process the payment and the member will get his 10 cents and that's it?
I'll go with the tax directive one first because that's the easier one. Right? So SARS will not tell you if there's outstanding. They will tell you if there's outstanding or not if you do a quote, but it won't tell you how much. The only time you know how much is when you've applied for the tax directive. So the first time even the administrator knows is once the tax directive is applied. And the I don't want to pay the IT88 outstanding tax is not a valid reason to cancel that tax directive. And so the bottom line is it is putting administrators and funds in an incredibly difficult situation because a member can go online on their e-filing profile and do a SARS has promised this capability and do a dummy check to see what their tax rate will be and what the marginal tax rate they'll pay. And also if there's IT88 standing. But again, they won't be told how much on that quote. So the only time a member is going to know if they're outstanding tax is when the actual tax directive is applied. And then the administrator has a certain period of time in which to deduct that money and pay it over to SARS. So it is an incredibly complex. So it will mean in those situations, there's no to go back to the member and go, oh, sorry, you're now going to have to pay an extra 10 grand tax. Do you still want to go ahead? They can't say no. It's done. So you're just going to have to make sure you clearly communicate to that member after you've paid to say, okay, of the X amount you've asked for, so much is your marginal tax rate, as told us by SARS. So don't phone Old Mutual and ask me why I'm charging you 32% tax. I don't know. Speak to SARS. And also SARS has asked for an extra 5 grand because of outstanding IT88. The balance is at, and it's in your account. That's going to be the only option.
It's going to be sad because, to Andrea's earlier point, it's not going. They're not going to blame SARS. They're going to say the administrator
of the
retirement fund is taking my money.
Well, in actual fact, it could be that the member is entitled to no refund.
Yep.
No, you that's give 30,000. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. You get zero. But not.
But thanks for the 30 grand. Your SARS is happy.
Look, then, and just on the question on the fee. So, yes, we've taken our decision on fees and we've started communicating with all our clients.
It's all go to SARS, you don't get anything.
If everything goes to SARS, then yeah, I suppose everyone loses. What was interesting, though, and I believe there is some concession from SARS, is the fact that the tax directive has to be on the 2,000 minimum. So originally there was a view so that if you effectively are not allowed to, for people who can only withdraw the minimum, deduct the fee and effectively not tax them on the fee. So if you pay a 100 rand fee, you effectively apply on 1,900. Initially, my understanding was SARS did not want to go, and their view was 2,000 rand minimum, so you would effectively had to tax the people that withdraw the minimum on their fees as well. My understanding was now that they are comfortable to accept the post-tax.
That's the gross versus net debate, which was fun, because when we started, they said we had to tax the gross value, and we said no, if it's in the rules of the fund to say that the fund has deducted the fees, then it should be taxed net, because that's what the crews, they didn't necessarily agree, they've changed their view. So we're now taxing net. And they're removing the validation of the tax system. So they're not going to check if it's 2 grand gross. They're going to put the onus on the administrators to prove that they have put that 2,000. Because the other challenge is, and you know, if I say I want 2,000, or that's all my amount and it's 2,000, and then by the time you've disinvested and got the money back, it's less than 2,000 because of market movement. What do you do? Go, oh, sorry, and we got to cancel it. So there are some practical elements as well in terms of breathing space and tolerance that needs to be taken into account with these. So the fact that SARS has now removed their validation checks and leaving it up to the administrator actually does make it a bit simpler. Mm.
Are there any more
yes.
that you want to ask? Can I ask Brian a question first? Because this one I do want to actually find out, and I'm conscious of time. That gratuity versus the one-third problem that we have, you've clearly thought about it. You're not the only fund that has this problem. Yeah. What are other funds? Is there anyone here with other municipal funds that have this issue?
I think Kwane should have
Anton?
One.
Have you spoken to each other about your methodologies? It would be interesting to hear what both of you are thinking in terms of that issue.
So I can start. For the GPF, we've proposed a change in the accrual rate going forward that will allocate a higher portion of your retirement savings to a gratuity. To mirror the one-third. It has not yet been approved. Or it's been approved by the board, but it has not yet been accepted by the other stakeholders. So as things stand, we're still using the current accrual rates, but we're confident that once they fully understand the implications of it, that they will give us the go-ahead.
Okay. So the issue here is whether there's a gratuity benefit that's not a third of the benefit. So the gratuity doesn't match to the one-third savings, so now there's an issue with that. Anton, your fund?
Thanks. I've only got 200 members, so I'm waiting for Brian to see where he lands.
So you're going to be changing your accrual rate?
No. In terms of my view, most municipal funds with those accrual rates have been close to defined benefit accrual or close to new membership for defined benefits for quite some time. I would think that you would need to almost carry another pot or another component for if say the gratuity is 25% of the benefit, if you calculate it at the valuation between 25% and 33% to almost have a portion of the pension that can be commuted as well. So I think another component or another service component to be taken account of. Thanks.
And Brian, you're going to have to implement that before your statute gets changed, presumably?
Yeah.
Okay. Fun. The other one is I wanted to deal with also on the DB side before we go into the other questions was on funds with underpins and what the thoughts are around that. So I've heard from some people that are going to some. I've heard one comment that said it's only bites at retirement, therefore you don't need to consider the underpin. The other kind of thinking is actually whenever you do you run it like a DCE fund, and then whenever you do a withdrawal, you just adjust the underpin service proportionately to whatever the MIR would have been at that point. So I don't know if the panel or anybody in the audience has thoughts that are different to that.
Yeah.
How are you going to deal with this?
So yes. Look, so, I mean, I think from our perspective, we do have a couple of funds with DB underpins. And I think it would boil down to a case-by-case basis, but there's a couple of principles to consider when you've got a DB underpin. So the underpin typically bites not necessarily on retirement, but on exit, there would be a check. So the question is whether or not this underpin check should happen at the point when you do a saving component withdrawal. So if you withdraw from it, are you withdrawing your DC portion only and that's what you get, or do you do a check and there's potentially a higher benefit available due to your DB? And so that's one aspect of the underpin to consider is what should apply to saving component withdrawals. Do you also check which one is higher?
But you need to adjust the service.
You would have to, in any event, I think, adjust it, because at the point when someone then does exit the fund due to, say, retirement, and they've taken money from their DC pot, you would, to a certain extent, have allowed for it in the DB underpin in some way or format. Because typically these funds with these underpins, I've seen one where the rules allow for some reasonable kind of measures to apply for these underpins to bite. So, for example, if you make additional voluntary contributions to the fund, these are taken out of your DC component when you compare the benefit components, so that you don't inadvertently disadvantage yourself by making, you know, DC contributions and it not being accounted for in your DB side. And also where funds have said if you're not invested in the default strategy of the fund where you do MIC choice, the DB underpin no longer applies. So in the current regime, there's already some measures that rules of engagement in terms of how and when these DB underpins should be considered and how they would work. And I would assume funds would have to, on a case-by-case basis, consider what's fair and appropriate in that fund scenario. But similarly to funds where they offer, say, self-insured risk benefits on death, the fact that the benefit is not necessarily the fund credit means that there needs to be an allowance. So to the extent that the fund credit is affected by a withdrawal, some offsetting allowance need to be brought across for the DB underpin. And that has to go into your rules and that has to go into your engagement with your trustee. So we've actually had a client that said they understand it's a benefit improvement in the death case scenario. They're comfortable with it. They'll give members a higher benefit and they don't want to offset it. So there's very much a discussion, I would think, that needs to happen with the trustees and the guarantor, the employer, to understand how the trustees would like to operate with that underpin. But good luck to the actuaries that work on those funds. I'm glad I'm not one of them.
Are there any questions on underpins, the gratuity versus one-third savings? You can pretty much ask now because you've got everybody that deals with it here, so this is probably the biggest pool of advice. Stephen?
Okay, so it's not that, but I do want to ask a question of Andrea and a question of Michelle. So for Andrea, last year you came and you spoke to us, having gone to the International Congress of Actuaries in Sydney, in Australia, and one of the things I remember very clearly is that you spoke about these two ladies from Mexico who were speaking about the retirement reforms that their pensions model has gone through in Mexico and how confusing it is now for everybody. That it's in such a total shambles because of the fact there's been so many changes that you have to keep in mind this law applied before that date and from this date it was this law. If those two ladies were sitting in this room, do you think they'd be going, ooh, this sounds familiar? are we going to have that same situation of just complete chaos that you described to us last year?
So what happened in that jurisdiction, which is interesting, so firstly, they've got 19 pots, not four, so it is significantly more complicated, but what also hampered them was that inability to communicate. So in there, the communication was legislated by the registrar only. Pension fund administrators and trustees weren't allowed to communicate to their members. The only communication that could ever go out was the approved communication from the, I mean, they even dictated the font size and the pictures that could go onto that communication. So it was coupled with them having changed the regime and applying grandfathering every time. That was the one aspect of it. But a very big problem in their regime was the inability to communicate and to effectively engage. So they were basically prohibited from engaging their members directly. And so they could not necessarily explain, in their view, and that was kind of the point of the presentation, was the importance of communication and this ability to effectively communicate, because they couldn't effectively communicate to members. So they've got unclaimed benefits that is bigger than our unclaimed benefit problem in South Africa. But it's not because people have got historic benefits. These are also active people. It's just because they've got so many records that when they access or when they withdraw from one, there's this inability to put everything together and pay it out in its entirety. So it's not a situation of historic benefits, it's a situation of not being able to reach that person, consolidate and effectively communicate, say, but you've got more, let's claim all of it. And so the communication aspect of a successful legislative change for me was actually the key that they wanted to make there. Not the fact that it's complicated or that there's grandfathering that applies. That was obviously problematic given how many times it happened, but that I didn't understand to be their big issue. Their big issue being this inability to effectively communicate.
I'm just hoping that I'm not, in a couple of years' time, having to write another recommendation for you to go
to the Japan,
next ICA,
please,
in Japan.
That would
so
be lovely.
Tell them about how we did things wrong.
Stupot, so a South African experience. I'm seeing it.
Go tell everybody how we did it right, hopefully. Yeah. So, Michelle, this morning, before you arrived, the idea already came up about concern about the retirement pot. So everybody's gotten very, very excited about savings pot and everything that's going to be happening with the savings pot. And people have not been focusing on this compulsory pension preservation requirement. And for me, it was a massive surprise that two pots were so readily accepted, especially by trade unions who had originally gotten involved with the retirement funds in the 80s to fight the old apartheid government that wanted to bring in compulsory pension preservation. So the concern was raised this morning, what happens in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, when people are unemployed and they've been told, well, you've got 150,000 rand in a retirement pot, tough luck, you're not going to get it. In the submissions concerning two pots, we had this debate. So we as the Actuarial Society, we said that we strongly believe that there should be an exception, there should be exemption that applies to an individual who's got a retirement pot, who's been retrenched or who's been unemployed for a long period of time. And a CISA smashed us and bashed us. Sorry that I'm talking so much, I'm just setting up the scene. The compromise was that, guys, listen, so, and this was Alana Makabela, the previous head of the FSCA, who said this, guys, we're arguing about small pots of money here. We're going to come back to this in phase two. And everyone said, okay, that's an excellent idea. We'll come back to this in phase two. So when phase two comes, we're then going to relook at this, because we're also considering the fact that the Social Security benefits, basic income grant in South Africa could have changed by then. So it all sounds very nice. Is there going to be a phase two? And if so, when? And if so, what else would be in phase two besides that one point that we raised as asset?
I thought you were going to ask me a question I could answer.
But are you expecting anything else in a phase two?
So yeah, it's a difficult one, right? Because I think, first of all, like the one thing, we'd have big problems in South Africa. There's no doubt. We've got high levels of unemployment. We haven't got a great social security system in many places. But private sector or private retirement funds and people's retirement funds can't be expected to solve all problems. Mm. And at the moment, the big challenge we have is we pay benefits out on retrenchment, right? Because they can get 100%. And and then when those same people reach retirement, they have nothing. The old age state grant is all they've got. And it just essentially kicks the can down the road. So I think one of the elements was very much around, there's a lot more than just what we do in the retirement fund industry that needs to fix things like employment growth. All of those factors need to be, they can't be solved by your retirement fund. But I think, and agreed, one of the big challenges around when there's discussion of do we preserve and is it via retrenchment or not, or what are these benefits, and I know it's discussion about phase two, is to start off with, yes, your retirement pot's going to be very, very small. And secondly, that's what your savings pot is for, right? So retrenchment would be seen as an emergency. So if properly managed, that's exactly what your savings pot should be used for, plus you've still got your vested pot. Phase two, will there be a phase two? I mean, I think there's definitely, look, let's be honest, we've had an incredible amount of changes, been thrown in this industry in a very short period of time, and most of us can and are, and two hands start explaining this needs to be tweaked and that's going to be changed. I will be very interested, and I was saying to someone, I'm going to do a study on behavioral and what people actually do when we go live and how this works, because we're all doing assuming what's going to work, and we're all doing different ways because, of course, none of us are talking to each other because you can't talk to competitors, so you've got to all work on your own process in your own way, and your own doing, pray to goodness, you're doing it the best you know way how. So I don't think there's a date to say this is the date to which phase two is going to be started or discussed. But I do think we need to have some time where nothing else changes and we actually just settle everything down. Because I mean, we know that this is so. I say to people, having compulsory preservation, which internationally people look at you so funny when you say, "Oh no, people can cash out their full pensions," and like, what? Because it's so unique to us in many ways. If we want to be saving for retirement, so I do believe that compulsory preservation is the fact that it's coming through now, and it's going to be an absolute win. And we've also seen how powerful it's going to be in the long term, because if you have compulsory preservation and you see what that does to increase in retirement outcomes at retirement, well, then that reduces things like dependency generations dependency ratio, sandwich generation, all those other social issues that come through because people can't save enough for retirement. I haven't directly answered because I don't know. But there's a lot more change coming forward. I mean, Treasury said that, right? They've said that they want to settle two-pot down, and then we need to look at auto-enrollment, yeah, and that, then we need
that's what,
to...
That was my next question. Is auto-enrollment going to happen first or phase two of two-pots?
I don't know. I really don't
Maybe
know.
The innocence is...
We need you to know, Michelle.
But you know what? I really... If we look at where we've come as a retirement fund industry and where we've been... There has been so much phenomenal positive change, and you can't change these things overnight. I mean, the fact that we got annuitization in, I mean, that's a huge plus. We've managed this focus of being about costs and bringing costs down, and I mean, where we are with member communication and how much communication now gets sent to members. I mean, these are massive moves we've had positively in our industry. So yes, in the long term, we know we need some sort of auto-enrollment or forcing employers to put their staff on funds and getting more people in retirement funds so we can stop having so many people at retirement depending on Social Security and grants. But when and how? But I think if I look at what's been done up until now, we've come far.
Look, and I agree with that. I think one mustn't underestimate what an opportunity two-pot now provides for people in the retirement annuity space. So guaranteed, understandably, it's a bit difficult for people who've already been in it, but for employers that currently don't have retirement arrangements in place, there's this whole new avenue of considering a retirement annuity because your accessibility rights is now the same. It's a level playing field. We've done a lot of work to level the playing fields between the funds, so they operate for a new member in exactly the same way. Same tax rules, same access rules, and that should allow us to bring more people into the net. So I agree with Michelle in that there's, you need time to understand the impact of all the legislative changes. And I mean, to the question of what can fund actuaries do, I do believe more needs to be done to demonstrate the impact of the reform changes, and not only two-pot, but even like default regulations. What is kind of the take-up rates that funds see for in-fund preservation? What is the take-up rates that funds see for their annuity strategies? How frequently they change it? How effective is it? And I think if there's an ability to demonstrate the positive impact of the reforms, there will be more buy-in into the system in general as well. So there's a lot that can be done, in my view, to demonstrate, but it is a long-term game. You're not going to see the benefit that day one. But that impact needs to be demonstrated over time, and that's hopefully somewhere where we can play a role.
And I think just to add to that, if I can, there's such this perception of compulsory preservation and you keeping my money. We need to really also change the narrative, because it creates a lot of panic but I want my money. It's my money. Who are you to tell me what to do with my money? When actually it's your money. It's your money. You're going to use it at retirement. So we also need to be, when you talk about people resisting and unhappy with compulsory preservation and being able to access it, we've got to be careful with how we position it, because we're making it sound as if it's going to be locked away, we're going to throw around the key and it's not your money anymore. Mm. So we also need to just help people see over time when they start seeing the benefit of what we're bringing in, how well it's working, etc. I mean, members are starting to say we're going to start putting more money in the fund now, because if there's a chance I can access some of it while I'm still working, then why don't I put more in? So I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the next while. We've got to be very careful not to time box ourselves into these are what we've got to do by now and then. Because I think just something as big as this over the next 4 or 5 years is going to be phenomenal. And you're right, the annuity market, like the availability, there's always been this argument of insurers are not bringing out enough annuity options for members at retirement on low income. And the other argument, well, there's no demand for annuity options for people low income at retirement because they take everything in cash. Yeah. But as that starts to switch, we're going to see huge amounts of variety there as well. So I think there's a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, just to point out,
no,
sorry.
We're out of time, Stephen.
I'm speaking, I'm the next speaker, so I'm speaking in my own time.
Okay.
So it's fine. I just wanted
Do you want
to
come up so long?
I just wanted to reiterate, when we were providing feedback on two pots, from the start, we as the Actuarial Society always were in favor of two pots. I had a couple of individual pensions actuaries writing to me to say, Stephen, this is a terrible idea. We already have only 6% of people going into retirement in a financially stable way, and now we're allowing them early access. Yes, because of the dream. We've always had this dream of compulsory preservation. But I do think it's going to take a long time, like you say, Michelle, to work out, to see what happens. And so we look forward to Andrea saying, what's the one after Japan? We'll
I have to check.
Okay, we're going to start. You're going to have to warn your husband. The two of you are going to be going to every ICA to go give updates. Where's Joanna run away? Okay, are you going to dismiss your panel, or can I just dismiss your panel? Okay. Thank you very much to the panel. Please give the panel a hand of applause.